This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballo, your 20th Century American History Guy. Most weeks on our show, we rip a topic from the headlines and we explore the historical context. But there's been a palace coup at Backstory. Peter Onuf, our 18th century guy, has taken over the studio. He's holding us hostage and making us talk about the 4th of July the entire hour.
He said it's only right that here on our nation's birthday that we take some time to honor the founders.
Ed, I don't know about you, but I really don't quite understand how we're going to spend the whole show talking about the 4th of July, yawn.
Come on. I have deep misgivings too, Brian. You know, I mean,
hey, guys, hold on to your horses. I am going to read the entire Declaration of Independence. You know, it's a long document.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great. No, just joking. I wouldn't do that.
That sounds actually kind of interesting now that you mention it.
Well, there is a lot of interesting stuff in the Declaration if you get past the early bits about all men are created equal.
Wait a second. That's the only part I know, Peter.
Well, yeah, where are you coming from? You know, you've got to read that.
20th century,
right,
man.
20th century. You got to read it backwards.
You mean like Hebrew?
Yeah, or Arabic. Let's be, open and universal.
Or like the White Album by the Beatles for the head on.
Just put it on backwards. Seriously, are you ready to be serious?
I am.
Okay, yes.
There is great stuff in the body of the Declaration about all the things that are getting Americans upset. About all the ways in which they've been betrayed, all their grievances against George. He dissolves and prorogues assemblies so that we can't govern ourselves, or our provincial liberties are being destroyed. He moves capitals from here to there, shuts down courts. It's George III, supposed to be our father. That's what a sovereign is. He's supposed to protect us. How do you feel protected when you've got your dad out there sending mercenaries to Boston to kill your countrymen?
Okay. Slow down, Peter. Mercenaries, Boston. Why don't you give some of us who live in the 21st century a little more context? Set the scene for us, summer of 1776.
Well, the theater of the war has shifted from Boston, where it all began at Lexington and Concord, and it's 15 months later. It's summer 1776. The British are in New York. And they're trying to stomp out this rebellion. Meanwhile, representatives from the different colonies, including Thomas Jefferson from Virginia, have gathered in Philadelphia. They have a Congress. They have to work something out because this war has been going on for 15 months. How are we going to win it?
Now, what was it that you were going on about a minute ago? Something about the Declaration, the sections of the Declaration that really mattered?
Well, Brian, I could try and explain, but better yet, I figured I'd let my friend Pauline Mayer do the honors. She's an historian up at MIT who published a wonderful book some years back called American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence. But when I sat down with her recently, she told me that that book came this close to never being written at all.
When I was first asked to write a, quote, modern history of the Declaration of Independence, I turned it down. I said, that document is hyped out of all proportion to its real significance. I mean, obviously, the Declaration of Independence was important, but what was its important? And, you know, we all think of it as important for, you know, the first couple phrases of the second paragraph. But that's part of a later life of the document. The most important part of the document in the summer of 1776 was the last paragraph. And people say, the last paragraph? What's that? That's the part that da-da-da-da-da-da declared independence.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And that was what was new. The statements of Enlightenment principles in the second paragraph that we all remember were not at all unique to the document. It appeared other places, most notably in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which had been drafted by George Mason and was adopted in June. So
the important parts of the Declaration at the time were all those grievances and complaints culminating in the Declaration, with the fanfare that you indicated. First parts that we remember most are boilerplate, potted social contract theory.
I think that's pretty much the way it looked initially. The question is how attention turned from the last paragraph to the second paragraph, and that takes about 20 years. What is clear is that there is nothing in either the Constitution or the First Ten Amendments that repeats those assertions in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. There's no statement about equality. There's nothing about natural rights that God gave all men. Now, as the children of Englishmen, and we hadn't quite stopped being the children of Englishmen in the 1790s, people felt the need of a document to cite, to ground those beliefs. And the Declaration was made to serve that function because it was the only national document that performed that function.
Pauline, one of the things I love about your book is that you ask us to think about the Declaration as a people's declaration. The people identified with these principles. Is it still a people's document in the same way it was during those decades of early American history when abolitionists and women at Seneca Falls in 1848
used it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is still a people's document in that people often justify whatever cause they're defending, however flaky, in terms of the Declaration
right.
of Independence. I mean, people send me clippings all the time. I remember there was somebody off the coast of Maine who was having great trouble. He used to dig clams on a neighboring beach, and the town decided to make their beach residence only. And he argued he had the Constitution on his side because it said he had a right to pursue happiness, and his happiness was digging clams on the neighboring beach.
Happy as a clam.
Well, right. Well, the problem is, of course, it's, among other things, it wasn't the Constitution. It was the Declaration of Independence, and it wasn't at all clear that it referred to digging clams.
There seems to be a fundamental contradiction or tension. If you think about the Declaration in its own context, it makes a kind of federal state that's recognized by other powers of the earth. That's the whole point of the Declaration, is to get recognition. But as you were just saying about your clam digger, the Declaration really has a libertarian gloss now, and a document that made the state is an anti-statist text.
That's a point. That's a good point.
Yeah, so it suggests in a way that these founding texts or documents are subject to multiple infinite interpretations, of course the Constitution is, and that every generation finds its own equilibrium, ways to read those texts together.
You know, if it wasn't true, they'd be dead. I mean, this is what Lincoln said when people were saying, Stephen Douglas, the Declaration was meant to declare independence. I mean, historically, of course, Stephen Douglas was right. Morally, Abraham Lincoln was right.
Yeah.
You know, it is a protector of personal liberty, said. If it wasn't that, if it just declared independence, it's history in the bad sense. That is, it's buried in the past. And you had to find new meaning in it that was relevant to your life, to the lives of people of a later time. Or it was just sort of, some archival piece of leftover junk from the past.
Well, thank you so much, Pauline, for helping us understand better the Declaration of Independence. It's been great talking.
Thank you, Peter. This was fun.
Pauline Mayer is a professor of history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's the author of, among many other things, American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence.
That's a great interview, Peter, and I like the clam digger part of it. What's so interesting is the way that history just refuses to stay still, that it meant very clearly one thing at that time, and today it means almost exactly the opposite. And it's almost like we should have a radio show about this that would help figure these things out.
Okay, but Peter, there's something I still don't understand. How did this become a national holiday? I mean, how do we go from this piece of paper to this celebration of great nationhood?
Okay, there are a lot of reasons for this.
There's always a lot of reasons.
Yeah, don't just be patient, young man.
Just give us the reason.
Yeah.
This is radio.
Okay, I'll tell you. The 4th of July became a really big deal in the 1790s, when, believe it or not, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and other so-called Republicans were mobilizing against the Federalist administrations of George Washington.
Yeah.
Guess what? The Jeffersonian Republicans styled themselves the Party of the People. And this is where it all comes together.
Yeah.
You know, the great holiday in the first years of American
independence. The 4th of July.
No. Hold on to your pants.
Yeah.
Or shoes or
pantaloons.
Shorts on your pantaloons and your breeches.
Yeah.
The great holiday is George Washington's birthday.
Huh.
And George, as you might think about it, there's a really strange coincidence here. George III, he was the king. George Washington,
he
was first president, father of his country. Kings are fathers. Father Washington happily had no children of his own. We're all his children, aren't we? But that's the principle of patriarchy, monarchy, and Republicans like Jefferson say, no. What's great about this country of ours is that we're all equal. We're all equal.
Just like I wrote in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, I said that.
Yeah.
And so when the Republicans say, down with Washington,
yeah,
up with Jefferson, but it's not Jefferson because Jefferson was channeling the American people in the Declaration of Independence.
And so, Peter, what you're saying is the reason this holiday is built around this piece of paper is we were trying to replace king worship with this Republican ideal, this notion of fraternity between men who are equal, at least in their status as citizens of this republic.
Yeah, it's a new form of male bonding between equal guys out having a parade and walking around and feeling good about each other, but fraternity as opposed to this kind of patriarchal idea.
This hierarchical notion.
Right, right.
You know, this totally shifts my conception of the holiday because, frankly, when I think about the symbolism of patriotism, when I think about nationalism, it's something that today is associated with the right.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that actually the origins of the 4th of July, this great patriotic moment, comes from the Jeffersonian Republicans. And in today's terms, these were the men of the people.
Mm-hmm.
These were people that we would say are on the left. Is that
something absolutely. It's an oppositional impulse. It's a self-consciously democratic impulse with a small d that is on behalf of the people against elites.
So, Peter, what you're really saying here is
the left had the flag. It had the symbols of nationalism
and
back in Jefferson's time.
And the big mistake the left of the 20th century made, starting burning the flag, right?
That's right.
Those are the things that people still remember and still infuriates them.
Huh. I could see a show.
Can you?
Since we already filled up part of one just by talking about it.
Well, let's celebrate. How about a parade? This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. We're talking today about the origins of Independence Day. You know, I got to say, based on what I've heard, at least in the first 15 minutes of this show, guys, I'm officially withdrawing my skepticism. I actually think this is going to be a pretty interesting show.
Well, get on the bus, Brian. Let's celebrate.
So, Peter, before the break, you were talking about how Jefferson and his fellow Republicans basically invented the 4th of July in the 1790s. You were saying it was an alternative to the kind of king worship that took place on Washington's birthday. Can you go a little farther?
Well,
what happens down the road? What happens after Jefferson dies?
You know what I think is interesting
is that
the 4th of July becomes an opportunity for a peace-loving people to be militaristic.
And yet I thought it was just like fireworks and hot dogs and mattress sales.
Fireworks, fireworks, fireworks. What does that suggest to you?
Explosions?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like, where are most people likely to encounter explosions?
4th of July. Battles?
It's we just forget this. It's in battles. Exactly.
Wow.
Right. It's the experience that a lot of Americans had. One of the things that the 4th of July has always done is provide an opportunity for veterans to put on the old tattered uniform and to be the center of attention for a day.
And for the rest of us, it provides an opportunity to blow things up. Fireworks have been a part of the 4th of July since the very beginning, and it's safe to say that in general, the rule has been the bigger the better. That was especially true out west, where there was all kinds of space and you could make as big an explosion as you wanted. At least that's what James Heinze says. He's the author of the 4th of July Encyclopedia. Peter and I caught up with him just in time for the big day.
There began in 1876 explosions and rockets launched on tops of mountains.
On purpose.
on purpose. They were planned. And in 1901, they had the largest explosion in the history of the 4th of July celebration up to that date, occurring on top of Pikes Peak when they built a giant fire up there and let loose at least 18 large barrels of oil and gasoline into the fire, which caused sparks and flame to go up hundreds of feet in the air. And
so you could see that for miles around.
Exactly. Yeah. They could see it from Denver. Out west, the fireworks of choice, if they didn't actually have fireworks, was dynamite.
And we would just like to pause here and tell any young people who may be listening to the show, we are not recommending exploding dynamite to celebrate our nation's birth.
So tell us about the parade. Did somebody figure out, some brilliant genius figure out, if you just got all the drunks to move in one direction and called it a parade and gave them some flags, that it would maintain some order?
No, actually, the first parades were actually very well organized. The military, the militia, as well as the citizens would typically meet at a designated location, and they would march to the place where the ceremony was going to be held.
Right.
The first largest parade in the history of the country occurred in Philadelphia in 1788. That parade was more than a mile long, and the idea there was to get the people organized so they would ratify the Constitution.
Now, you were talking about this being celebrated out west. How about down south after the Civil War was over, or even before the Civil War? Has the 4th of July been a Southern tradition?
It was extremely a Southern tradition. In fact, Charleston, South Carolina had some of the most interesting 4th of July celebrations. The Civil War all but put an end to the 4th of July celebration in the South for many years to follow.
Right.
So when did that change?
That began the change at the centennial. Richmond, for example, that was the capital of the Confederacy. In 1876, that was the first time they flew the American flag over the courthouse there. Yet the South was not totally healed until the Spanish-American War, when the boys of the South and the North fought once again together on a battlefield.
That's interesting. It took the South almost 40 years to begin celebrating that holiday again. Wow.
Exactly.
So once again, the theme of the military and patriotism being sort of the engine that drives the 4th of July.
Jim, it's been wonderful talking with you. Happy 4th of July to you.
And thank you very much, and happy 4th to you.
Jim Heinze is the author of the 4th of July Encyclopedia, published in 2007. Here are a few other authorities on the holiday, but these folks are a little closer to the action.
My name's Ray Cadell. I'm a real estate broker here in town. I've been involved in the 4th of July fireworks here for 15 years or so. We're in Charlottesville, so of course it's all about the Revolutionary War and Thomas Jefferson, and there's a lot of history in this town. But it all points to that moment when it gets dark and stuff starts blowing up.
I'm Susan Christian. I'm director of the Mayor's Office of Special Events here in Houston, Texas, and I also co-produce our annual celebration for July 4th. It's called Chevy's Freedom Over Texas, with fireworks presented by Shell. And we have tanks and aircraft, and all of the branches of the military are represented. We top off the evening with the nation's largest land-based fireworks show. When we celebrate, we do that in a really big way here in Houston.
I'm Steve. I work for the Corner Store Garden Center, and we sell fireworks during the 4th of July, and week of 4th would be the busy week. That's when everybody wants to do it at the last minute. I reckon the children would be the ones go liking. I mean, it's almost like Christmas to them. I reckon they just like to see the bright colors.
We're going to go to the phones now because we want to know what some of you think about the 4th of July.
We got a call from out there in dynamite country. It's Kelly in Missoula, Montana. Kelly!
Hi!
Hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, I'm working on a book about Laura Ingalls Wilder. And actually, the 4th of July figures importantly in her books, mostly in a later book, Little Town on the Prairie, that takes place in DeSmet, South Dakota. And but it seemed like the focus was more on, like, they read the Declaration of Independence, saying, "My country, 'tis of thee." And it was kind of all about farmers being free and independent. And I was kind of wondering if it meant, if maybe the 4th of July meant something different to farmers in the West.
Well, tell us, first of all, what it meant for Laura Ingalls Wilder. What was it like in South Dakota?
Well, they had just gotten out there, and it was basically a brand new town, and they had just kind of, you know, erected you know, kind of the false town fronts, and they had a dusty main street. And this was the first celebration at the kind of the first gathering as a town. So they'd kind of put something together, and it consisted of drinking a cup of lemonade and watching pony races.
That's
and a couple of fireworks.
It's the lemonade that rings untrue here.
Peter, tell us about the 4th of July in the early part.
This is in the 1870s?
Yes.
Ooh, good guess. I think the nature of celebrations did change significantly over the previous 50 or 75 years or 100 years. And that business about drinking and lemonade might have sounded silly, but there was much more alcohol consumption earlier on. By the 1870s, you got a lot of teetotalers, a lot of opposition to strong drink. The temperance movement is very powerful.
Especially among women.
Yeah.
And especially in the West.
Right.
What you're seeing there is in some ways a 4th of July suitable for young women.
Sure.
Right.
But
right.
I'm guessing behind some of those false storefronts, they were celebrating the country in another way.
You'd also get this notion of a civic celebration that you're describing, in which everybody's doing the right thing. It's not boisterous. It's not partisan. People are not beating up on each other. And earlier 4th of July celebrations tended to be very contentious.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The idea of the Declaration and of Jefferson as its author was a partisan thing in the 1790s and early 1800s. That is, it was Jefferson against the Federalists, that is, the administration. And then later in the party system that emerged in the 1830s and 40s, there were a lot of counter demonstrations of Democrats and Whigs having alternative celebrations, trying to win over popular favor and so forth.
Well, I'm guessing the 1870s was the time that people were looking in the wake of this horrific Civil War and this just, you know, debilitating Reconstruction and horrible Depression. Any symbol of national unity and pride was surely welcome.
Yeah.
And that one of the questions I wanted to ask you guys is, we know that by the end of the 19th century, the nation is knit together more through railroads and the telegraph, and there is more of a kind of sense of nation. Mm-hmm. So to what extent in the early 19th century was the 4th of July the only time that people thought about the entire country? How often did people out in the West or in small towns in the South, let's say in the 1830s, 1840s, how often did they even think about the nation?
I think maybe more than you might think, Brian. I think the symbols of nationhood, spread eagle, the flag, and then patriotic holidays like the 4th or Washington's birthday, that they would be important. Even if there's no real nation there, I think that's your point. Nobody's directing this thing. Nobody has a central directorate for propaganda.
Kelly, can you help us out on this question? I mean, you've described a scene that's very local. To what extent do you see any indication that kind of they're even aware of being part of a larger nation except through some of these symbols?
Well, it's kind of interesting because when Laura Ingalls Wilder, she wrote the books, but her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, kind of heavily edited and helped out. She was actually a more famous author in her day than Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Interesting.
And she was a staunch kind of freewheeling libertarian. And she got really radical in her later days. She lived in Danbury, Connecticut, but she would farm all her own vegetables. She didn't have to spend any money in the economy and pay taxes. And she actually declined work, earning a certain amount of money, so she didn't have to pay taxes. And it's been said in this particular passage where Laura suddenly steps aside and kind of has these internal musings where she talks about being free and independent. Americans are free, and they don't obey kings. And that it's been kind of, that was where Rose Wilder Lane kind of slipped in her libertarian.
Interesting. So independence was important to her, that it was her own independence. And of course, that's happened throughout American history, that Americans confused their independence with the nation's independence.
It's interesting that she had to move back east to become free, kind of violation of American story.
She loved Rose Wilder Lane, actually, kind of, you know, her and her mother hadn't worked a lot together, but she was very enamored of this idea of the Homestead Act and farmers being free and independent. And of course, it's not really quite true because farmers, of course, are dependent on the market. But there's a whole thing in the book that goes over and over again about how, like, being a farmer is not like being a storekeeper or being a businessman, or, you know, it's being out there on the land.
And just imagine, would anybody have gone to South Dakota if it hadn't been for the railroads?
Right.
And it's not even clear then why anybody would go to South Dakota.
We apologize. Yeah, well,
that always shocked me because when I read them, I just saw South Dakota as being like, I saw it as, you know, a westward progression and that people hadn't even made it to Washington, Oregon yet. But of course, what was happening is they're kind of filling in the middle.
Yeah, right.
So they were giving away free homesteads so that people would go farm there.
And it's interesting. Now, of course, we think about the Dakotas with a degree of nostalgia, and it was once the frontier. On that elegiac moment, we want to thank you for calling, Kelly.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
We're talking today about the origins of July 4th. Our 18th century guy, Peter Onuf, is just blowing our minds with all his knowledge on this topic. Peter, who's next on the phones?
We got Greg from Charleston, West Virginia on the line. Greg,
hello,
welcome.
Hello there. How are y'all?
Welcome to Backstory. Give us a question.
My question would be, what happened to the actual revolutionary spirit in America?
Ooh.
And was there a real American Revolution?
Ooh, I love that question. You know what John Adams said? He said that would be the second president of the United States. He said 1/3 of all Americans during the Revolution were patriots, 1/3 were loyalists, and the other 1/3 were fence sitters, or as Tom Paine called them, sunshine patriots. Now, historians quarrel with those fractions. I'm inclined to think that the fence-sitters were even larger in number.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and depending on which way the wind was blowing, otherwise known as the British Army, people were inclined to take oaths of allegiance to whichever power was on the ground.
So, Peter, what happened to those fence-sitters as the Revolution went on?
You know, you guys could tell us about other wars. But everybody has a good war in retrospect. They got good stories to tell. They're not going to talk about how they ran home as soon as they can. Desertion, of course, was at very high rates. But, you know, there really was a kind of a forgiveness policy. Anybody who could make believe that he or she was a good patriot, you're cool. And actually, people who were loyalists were welcomed back into the fold.
And was celebrating Independence Day one of the ways they proved their loyalty, citizenship?
Since they didn't put their bodies on the line during the war itself, they put their bodies on the line walking down the street.
So what you're saying is that they sort of invented revolutionary spirit after the fact.
Absolutely right, Ed. There was spirit. Okay, but the myth was that everybody had it.
Got it.
And lots of people had it for a few months early in the war. It's a lot of fun thinking about killing people. Ah, that sounds terrible. But, you know, it's sustaining it over the long haul that's the tough thing.
Greg, I feel we've stifled your spirit.
What does
revolutionary spirit mean to you?
The thing that surprises me is the fact that one group of capitalist overlords simply replaced another. You know, and a lot of people don't want to look at it that way. They don't want to feel that that is the answer to an American Revolution. But in many ways, the British oligarchy was simply shunted aside and a new oligarchy was established.
Well, Greg, you know, the only thing wrong with that proposition is, in fact, it was the old provincial ruling elite who maintained power afterwards. So it's not really a new displacing an old.
So what was there a revolution then, Peter?
The answer simply is that you had a bunch of provincial elites.
Yeah.
And they wanted to remake the empire in their own image.
So there's
That's what Greg was saying.
Yeah, yeah. You know, all men are created equal. That's in the Declaration of Independence. What patriot leaders meant was that all Englishmen are created equal, particularly elite Englishmen, and they didn't like the second-class treatment they were getting.
So, Peter, how did they get at least 1/3 of the people to support that?
Well, the word that you 20th century historians have for this is propaganda.
No, it's actually false consciousness.
False consciousness, you name it.
But that's too big a word to use on the show.
No, I think that's a silly and dismissive way to put it.
So take it back, Brian.
Yeah, I do take it back.
Well, I'm going to take back what I said, too. Can we take back this whole phone call?
Greg, you want to withdraw anything?
No, I would say this. It's one of the hallmarks of the modern world that large numbers of people who don't know each other can imagine themselves as being members of a common community.
Ah, and Peter, does the 4th of July reinforce that? Is that maybe what the 4th of July is all about?
Civic rituals are very important to remind us that whether we quarrel with the founders or we celebrate their achievement, they're all we got.
Well, they're an interesting group of people that developed an idea that was new enough to create, you know, an entire economic paradigm in the United States.
No question about it, Greg.
That was not there originally. Now, that paradigm is what I consider not a revolutionary paradigm, you know. It was a new and, in many ways, very sort of modern concept. You steal land from Indians and you pay off your veterans. It was a great process, and it went on for 40 years, you know.
Well, Greg, welcome to American politics. And I got to say, I don't think there is such a thing as a real revolutionary spirit. There never has been a real revolution, or the ones that are real are ones that lead to massive destruction of life and property. One of the great things about the American Revolution is that so few people were slaughtered. Compare it to the French Revolution. But this is supposed to be a happy discussion about our national
health.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah. So we got America cheap, is what you're saying, right?
It didn't cost that much.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then we bought other big parts of it.
And it's a big country, and we love it. So, Greg, thank you for being so provocative.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
I appreciate talking to you.
Great. When we get back, we'll hear more of your thoughts about the 4th of July. We're also going to travel back in time to the 1850s and listen to one of the most eloquent speeches about independence since, well, independence.
We'll be right back. Don't even think about going away.